You're listening to Driving Law, a podcast by Kyla Lee about all things related to the rules of the road.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Driving Law. I am driving while I'm recording Driving Law.
Yeah,
I own them remotely, not driving, Paul Doroshenko.
Yes, and you're the host, and you're the one behind the wheel. I'm assuming that you're doing it lawfully and safely. I mean, hands-free for sure.
Yeah, I'm hands-free, don't worry.
Using the Bluetooth in your car, that's smart. Okay.
Yeah, I just, unfortunately, I've had a 7:30 a.m. phone call, and then I had to drive several hours to get to court, and I had to stop multiple times on the way to do hearings, and then I had a hearing immediately before court, and then immediately after court, a video court appearance, and then I have another video court appearance, so I have to get as close back to my final destination as possible before my next video court appearance.
It's a busy day for you, and you're on the island doing all this, and yep. Where's Wrigley?
At my parents' house.
There you go.
That's probably good. Lounging around, going for long walks with my dad.
Well, at least he didn't have to take Wrigley for walks.
That's true.
That's true. You do that during the day, so do I, and so do other people in the office normally. So, you know, there's one little thing that you're alleviated for you, and I filled in for about a minute of a pre-trial conference for you today. And that was... That was a real waste of time putting a tie on for that.
Well, I'm very sorry that I didn't get out of court until 1:59.
Well, I'm glad you got on there soon, so I didn't have to do any of the real heavy lifting. But I've been heavy lifting things for the last few days. Something that we can talk about maybe some other point.
Yeah. What I really wanted to talk about, I think we're going to have like a real science-heavy. Science-heavy discussion today, because there have been two very interesting studies that have been done recently into breath and blood alcohol concentration. And you read them. I've read them. The first one relates to ways to actually get a lower reading, which you know a little bit about from your own experience.
Yes, indeed. I don't know if I've discussed this with a few people in the last week, because there's a history to it that relates to our office, right? Years ago, we posted a blog post where I explained that hyperventilating can lower your reading. And I knew this because I had done a little bit of experiments with it, but then I did some more serious experiments with it where I got my blood alcohol concentration to basically like 70 to 85 milligrams in 100 milliliters. And then I went outside in the cold in winter and I did a lot of deep breathing, hyperventilating, and I was able to reduce it by 10%. Like I was able to get myself down basically from above 80 to less than 80 by hyperventilating. And then, you know, it seemed to last for a few minutes after that. I'd go back inside into the warm air and it would be still fairly low for a while. And then it would rise back up and I could do it repeatedly. So, you know, we had discussed this before with one of the toxicologists that is a friend of ours, you and I, and tried to figure out sort of the science behind it. And it's always surprising, you know, the things that are not researched. And the more I think about it, you know, I can think of a dozen things that should be researched, but we posted a blog post on the website. How many years ago was that?
It was before the pandemic, because it was the year we had the party at my house, and it was one of my annual Christmas parties. I think it was one of my takeout parties.
I think it was 2017, 2018. Might have been before that. It's a long time ago. Anyway, so I posted a blog post about it, and it was one of our most visited blog posts. And I think it came with somebody complained to the Law Society that I was facilitating drunk drivers, and I had to respond to that.
Nope, that's science.
I think they discontinued that one. I'm not sure now. I also had some time after that, a reporter, and this was published on driving.ca, ripped us off, totally ripped us off, wrote an article about it without giving us any credit, and like lines almost right out of my blog post. Was pretty disappointed with that. And that was picked up all over the place. And then it led to people being concerned about this, and a study was conducted. And the study that was conducted is, as you know, we saw it a while back, and you and I were going to talk about it, but we had so many other pandemic issues and things like that to discuss. But essentially, it confirms what we said. It confirms that deep breathing will lower your reading. Go ahead.
I was going to say, it wasn't done, though. I'm not sure that I see your connection with the study being done because of the blog post, because of the driving.ca article. Because the study was done to address the issue of quickly and accurately measuring blood alcohol concentration using breath testing equipment in a hospital setting. And so there were a number of limitations that were described in the study, including that they were using, like, police breath testing equipment, but that some hospital breath alcohol testing equipment operates on a different scientific principle. Although at the end of the day, the conversion is still going to be the same. So the factors that are going to impact upon your initial input to the conversion ratio are going to have the same effect. But
yeah, I don't know if ours, we'll never know if our blog post was what triggered the thing in the end, but there was no discussion about it I could find anywhere on the internet before that. You know, when I wrote that blog post, there was nothing else that I could find to point to. And then, since then, there's been a few things. And interestingly, the BAC Data Master that I have, the first one that I got, which is the approved instrument, I think it's still an approved instrument, but it's not used anymore in Canada. But I got it when it was still an approved instrument, was from a hospital. And it had almost never been used. And I don't know why they would have one in a hospital, but it had only had like a 30 tests done on it in its entire lifespan. It's like a brand new device. So they used them in the hospitals. And they were concerned about the reliability and accuracy and started conducting this test. And interestingly, the study basically confirms what I just said. There's a few more points out of it that we can discuss here. But the way they approach it is like some people could be faking it, which is really problematic to me. I mean, the concern should be like accurately reflecting blood alcohol concentration with breath.
Yeah. So they did, they came up with a couple other things beyond hyperventilation that also lowered breath test results. I thought that was very interesting. So they experimented with a bunch of different mechanisms, like people who were deliberately providing what they called poor effort at blowing. Now, they provided enough effort to capture a sample on the device, so they met the minimum flow rate volume parameters of the device that was being used, but they just didn't continue blowing afterwards. They looked also at whether if you blew directly out of the front of your mouth versus if you blew out of the side of your mouth would impact the test, which to me is like such copy, right? Like you see this in police reports all the time. Oh, he was refusing. He was blowing out of the side of his mouth. Like, So what? The air is still coming out, right? It was super like weird cop speak, but I don't know how it filtered its way into the article.
That's what I noticed.
Yeah. The third thing that they tested was whether drinking water had any impact on the reported breath alcohol concentration.
And it does.
Yeah. People who drank water had a lower breath alcohol concentration than people who did not consume water. Low enough that they called it statistically significant.
Yeah. A few different things here that were affecting it that were statistically significant. One was mouth temperature. They theorize it's mouth temperature, right? Like it's still, this is really just in the end, them guessing, coming up with a hypothesis for the reason, which makes sense.
Perfect sense.
So, lower reading with that, and again with hyperventilating. And hyperventilating is an interesting thing because it's only in the last decade in the last 6 years, I think, that there's been an acknowledgement that you can reduce your blood alcohol concentration by breathing heavily. You can speed up your sobriety by breathing heavily. And that makes perfect sense because, of course, you know, on the one, your body metabolizes the alcohol, so your liver. But the other issue is, of course, you're exhaling it. That's how they measure it, right? The only way they can measure it is because it's coming out of your body. So if you're exhaling more of it, transferring more of it out of your lungs faster, then yeah, you're clearing that alcohol from your body by breathing.
Increasing that gas exchange effect.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's very interesting. So you can actually, like, you know, people are always like, oh, the only way to sober up is time. Well, actually, time and heavy breathing.
Yeah, and go for a jog and breathe heavily. There's a study that is entitled something along the line of paradigm shift in alcohol breath testing. And it's like already 20 years old. But in that study, it was more of an opinion piece by a very experienced toxicologist toward the end of his career, and he died during just in the last couple of years. But it basically talked about the fact that so many of these things are based on hypothesis, and you can't test it because you can't send probes down all the way down the trachea into the lungs, and you can't pull alcohol you can't pull air directly from the bottom part of the lungs or the middle part of the lungs. You can't, you know, so all of it is based on a hypothesis, assuming that the air is being exchanged by the lungs. And one of the hypotheses that they've realized is probably wrong is the air exchange from the lungs, because in fact, the alcohol is likely coming from the mucus that is collected in the lungs, which basically explains why you can hyperventilate and clear some of that alcohol, and that it takes some time, right? Because otherwise it would just immediately return to whatever that previous baseline was. But my concern with this, as you and I have talked before, and you know, some of these things, this is actually a good conversation about these issues, is that so many people, before they provide a sample, get so nervous that they end up with restricted breathing. And so they're standing there at the roadside, they're terrified, and they stop breathing. And, you know, that means that if hyperventilating can lower it, holding your breath can increase it.
Yeah, and that's also an instruction that many police officers will say. They'll say, okay, take a deep breath in, hold it. All right, now you can start blowing. And maybe it's only going to create a statistically significant 5 milligram of alcohol increase, but that's enough to go from a lawful BAC to an unlawful one.
Yes, in fact, it could be, you know, you're not going to go from 80 or 100 milligrams down to 49, but you might go from 79 to 85.
Yeah.
Or, you know, 95 to 101.
The thing I find concerning, like, and all the people who comment on some of the TikToks where I show like a 0.01 after putting some random thing in my mouth or using some product, and they're like, well, that's barely a reading. Well, yeah, it is barely a reading, but it's a significant reading when it comes to somebody who's at a 0.07, then adds a 0.01 to that and gets to a 0.08.
Yeah, because it adds up, especially with mouth alcohol. We know it adds up. Imagine if you're in ketosis, you know, and you hold your breath and you've had some alcohol, you know, the substances, it's isopropanol or acetone and ethanol coming out, they add up on the fuel cell. And I guess, you know, we've mentioned this before, the partition ratio, the breath to blood ratio. So 2.1 liters of air that you exhale is supposed to have the same concentration. It's not supposed to, but the theory that these devices work on is that 2.1 liters of your breath will have the same amount of alcohol as 1 cubic centimeter of blood. And, you know, if you're holding your breath how far off does that change the partition ratio, that breath to blood ratio?
Also, when we talk about exhaled air, you know, recognizing that this study looked at poor effort and then characterized poor effort as a factor that could lower the breath alcohol concentration. Think about what happens when people are actually blowing and what they're told. Keep blowing. And you can see on the device, like when I use it, and I can blow in front of a screen or a mirror or somebody else looking at the screen while I'm doing it, you can see that it is, you know, one bar, two bars, three bars, once it's got the minimum blow volume. But you keep blowing past the three bars before you get the click, which, you know, what, a solenoid engaging? So you're actually getting a sample of air that is more air than would be required by the device to test your results. And if poor effort means lower, and the theory is that this much air is equivalent to this much alcohol, then more air means more alcohol.
Yeah. Well, and then, of course, the police being trained forever and ever that deep lung air is the most accurate reflection, when unfortunately we know that's not true, but it is in every police manual, and good luck turning that ship around. Yeah. Right? Like the AlcoSensor FST manual, the BAC Data Master C, the Intox ECIR2, the Intoxilizer 5000, 8000, they all say that. And we know that, in fact, it's the mucus in the upper airways likely gives the best reflection of your blood alcohol concentration. And so then you've got these people who are nervous at the roadside, not police officers when they're taking their training, right? They're having a good time with their fellow officers and having a few drinks at the end to test themselves, or their test subjects or what have you. They're never nervous. You know, they're not all freaked out. They're not in a situation where like your whole body's shutting down in a fight or flight circumstance because you're dealing with a police officer and you're terrified. Yep. You know, they're doing it in a situation where they're comfortable and they're breathing probably normally.
They're drinking and hanging out with their like-minded colleagues.
Yeah. And they're going to provide that deep lung air, you know, it's going to be clear air because they're breathing normally. Maybe they're not going to provide deep lung air. Yeah, I just like the assumptions that they rely on, you know, these arrogant assumptions have always bothered me. And this article that we're speaking of now relies on a lot of those arrogant assumptions, but it kind of addresses them in the way that, like, okay, this is another problem, rather than why don't we address this issue? You know, like, this is a problem. People could be cheating.
The problem is huge. So there was another study that was done that looked at four different U.S. states, all of which used breath testing. And all of those states had different breath testing equipment that had a different minimum volume and also a maximum volume. So you couldn't go past a certain amount.
Yeah.
And it compared the results for the same, like the same person would blow into all four, the same, you know, presumably the same blood alcohol concentration, but the reading, this one person went from a 0.06 to over a 0.08 solely on the basis of the amount of air that they provided in the sample.
All the different instruments.
Yeah, 1.3 liters, which is what we use in British Columbia, gave the lower reading. I think it was 0.063 was the lowest reading. And when they got up to instruments that were taking 3 liters of air, they were finding that you could go to a 0.08. Over 0.08. Mm. Convicted. Guilty.
Yeah.
Guilty.
Yeah.
Simply because you just kept blowing until they accumulated enough alcohol in that sample to make you guilty.
It's disconcerting. It's... that breathing has such a difference in the and the timing of when the sample is obtained. My concern always is people attempting to provide a sample there at the roadside. You're at the roadside, you're not in a detachment where there's good light. It's all shocking and surprising for you. You're asked to step out. You're blowing into a roadside breath tester that's a 9-year-old device that's been used thousands and thousands of times and dropped and everything. And here you are, you end up with a refusal charge. And that's, you know, so often the case. And that's my concern. Or, you know, people holding their breath because they're terrified and then elevating their readings. And then the other concern, of course, is one that arose with your TikTok, and that is being in a car full of people who've been drinking. You know, warm car full of people who've been drinking, and they're exhaling, as we know, alcohol into the air. And ambient alcohol, you inhale it as well and will get absorbed into the mucus in your lungs. Won't necessarily get into your blood, but will get absorbed into the mucus of your lungs.
Secondhand breath alcohol concentration.
Yep. Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
Terrifying. Don't be a DD.
You want to talk about the British study about refusal circumstances?
Sure.
So there's an issue, right? In Canada, people are alleged to be refused to provide a sample. And it, in BC, it happens so quick at the roadside. You know, police officer pulls out the approved screening device, presents it to the person, gives them three chances, gives them three more chances, and then claims that it's a refusal. And in the manual for the device that they use, the approved screening device in BC, there's no course of action a police officer can do where the officer looks at the person and says, you know what? I don't think they're capable of providing a sample. I can't, you know, I don't think that they are. If you pull somebody over who's physically disabled and can't provide a sample, you have to assume. You must assume that they are refusing. There's no course of action where they are not, according to the manual. And so sets up a concern for disabled people and a real equality issue. But we've known for a long time, and toxicologists have told us that some people cannot provide a sample. And the RCMP know some people cannot provide a sample, but the manual assumes if they don't get a reading on the device, then the person is constructively refusing. They're actively attempting to not provide a sample. And arrogantly proceeding, both the police and the courts and the superintendent of motor vehicles have operated under this assumption. And we've seen some newsworthy cases where elderly women, you know, fought their cases and themselves usually, or hired a lawyer and didn't succeed despite the fact that they, you know, had no reason to try and obstruct it and were trying to provide a sample. And, you know, we've been tilting at windmills for this, against this for a long time. But then, you know, what comes along? The study out of England. Now, why out of England? Why not out of the United States? You know, we see a lot of the studies are conducted by the manufacturers of the approved instruments and breath testing equipment. And then other studies are conducted by the police. And so they're all questionable. But in the U.S., in most states, at least until quite recently, hasn't been any punishment for refusing to provide a breath sample. And so they didn't have this constructive thing that we have in Canada, but they also have the same thing that we have in Canada in the U.K. And so...
Yeah. Well, also in the U.S., like in the states where there is punishment for refusing... They just go to something like implied consent to a blood draw.
Yes, or there's that, or there's some option to refuse in some states where you just end up with like some sort of administrative
thing.
So, but in the UK, they've got the same thing, this constructive refusal situation. Some people decided to conduct tests of, to determine whether or not, you know, everybody could provide a sample and meet the parameters of these devices. And they decided to do it now because they've got such better technology to measure breathing. And part of that probably is a result of COVID, but certainly our you know, SARS and everything that we've had, these respiratory viruses that have been prominent in the last 20 years has likely led to it. But the study is fascinating because first they look at the existing material on it. And again, there's almost nothing out of the U.S. It's all just sort of written by the manufacturers and presumably to be used for Canada. And then they basically concluded all of the previous studies on this are really subject to bias. And then they started looking at the way that the attitudes in the justice system, and the attitude in the justice system is exactly what we see in the AlcoSensor FST manual. Everybody who doesn't provide a sample must be maliciously attempting to refuse, you know, they deliberately. And so that's a concern. And then they started looking, and what did they discover? Well, a significant portion of the population simply cannot meet the parameters of these devices.
I know I can meet the parameters of the devices because I have them and use them, but you know, after a couple times of having COVID, I've had a real significant decline in my lung function. The point that I was referred to the lung function clinic for testing, and I had a period of time, and it's recovered, thankfully, but I had a period of time where I had a COPD diagnosis.
I would have a problem right now providing a sample. And one of the things that they noticed was from age 40 and up, between the ages of 40 and 60, your loss of capacity, the risk percentage-wise of a loss of capacity doubles. Wow. And it's particularly so with women of smaller stature. And we know this. You and I know this. And we've seen it so many times.
Yeah.
And so you get these, you know, small women, 110-pound women who are 60 years old, and it doesn't really matter. Like most women probably from the age of 60 on are not going to be able to meet the parameters of that thing, especially in the dark at the roadside. And man, it's fundamentally like discrimination against women.
Yep.
And discrimination on the basis of your physical stature, which all other things should be.
Elderly.
Yeah. And these are all things that are protected by the charter. And yet what we have here is actual systemic discrimination because it's in their training material. Like it is the system. This is the system that they created to discriminate.
Even 2-year-old can do it.
Yeah, police officers say that all the time.
Have you administered the test to a 2-year-old? I should do that. I should take my 5-year-old niece and see if she can do it.
Oh, Kyla, I did this with my kids growing up. It wasn't until my children were 12 that they could provide a sample. And so far, they've still always blown zero, except when they've done experiments with soy sauce, which is a good sign. But yeah, this is one of the things police officers say. My 90-year-old grandmother with one lung can do it. Like, bullshit. Fuck you. You've never taken a police breath tester home and tried your 90-year-old grandmother and proved to me that she's got one lung.
I tried to administer the test on my grandmother. She couldn't do it. She got so freaked out. Like, you talk about people getting freaked out and having trouble breathing just because of their anxiety. She got freaked out with me administering the test to her at the dinner table at a Sunday dinner with all of our family there. Like, people that she knows that aren't going to judge her. She obviously had been drinking. There were no consequences to you know, blowing. And she could not do it. She got so overwhelmed, she couldn't produce the necessary sample of breath in a comfortable setting in her own home.
With her daughter, her granddaughter, who's like the least threatening person in her life.
I believe I up until the day she died was a perfect angel in her eyes. So.
Yeah. Little did she know. My dad knew I wasn't an angel, but from age 78 to 82, whatever it was, he passed away here a couple of years ago. But I tried to test him regularly, and probably about a third of the time he was able to do it. And there'd be some days when he just couldn't do it. Now, he was a lifelong smoker. had stopped in his 70s after he had a brain aneurysm. Actually, didn't stop after the aneurysm. He stopped after he nearly had to have his foot amputated because of poor circulation. He could not provide a sample most of the time, really struggled. And COPD from smoking is one of the things that they identified. And in that article, they go on to say, look, like it reasonably follows that a lot of people have been wrongly charged and wrongly convicted over the years. And this has been a concern for me. Now, I will tell you, I've been doing this now coming up on 24 years. And criminal refusals, I've never lost one. Somehow or another, I've always, you know, found something, usually in the process of the police investigation, that would lead to it, an acquittal on the refusal. But, you know, IRPs.
You're going to lose one. It's probably going to be the one where the person goes, fuck you, I'm not blowing. You don't have the right to demand that. Fuck you, I'm a natural person. I don't go by a name. I'm just a person.
Yeah, or they say too much time has passed, and then you maybe win. Anyway, as we discussed last week, my concern is that, you know, we deal with these adjudicators, and the government wrote the legislation. So if the adjudicator can't decide, the police officer wins the day. Like they have to just accept the police officer's evidence in circumstances where the manual gives the police officer no other option. So even police officers, sometimes you get it. Like sometimes you can see it in there that they're saying like they could not provide a sample rather than, you know, would not. And the person continues to blow right up until the end. They're trying to blow, you know, it's just not going. And the police officer will be saying, well, he was sticking his tongue in front of it. Yeah. Does he have a transparent mouth that you can see his tongue? I mean, bullshit. But the tribunal just rubber stamps these things. And all of these people who have had to go and sit, like non-drinkers or people who have like, you know, one ounce of port at the family dinner and then are driving home in their Oldsmobile. I guess not an Oldsmobile anymore, unless it's pretty old, but whatever, you know what I mean. And they get pulled over by, you know, Officer Gung Ho, who wants to make sure that he gets enough impaireds over the years to get the Alexis Award. And the person tries to provide the sample and they give him a mere six times and that's it. And they're a person who's incapable. And then you go and they, you know, they end up with their car impounded and everything, go through all that. But imagine having to go through all that and then go and take the Responsible Driver Program course and have to pay $1,000 to sit in a room with a bunch of people and be lectured about your drinking and driving. You know, to me, it's just absolutely horrendous. It is unconscionable. And I've been making the argument for over a year that this is systemic discrimination. It's discrimination against the elderly. It's discrimination against people on the basis of their body size. It's discrimination on the basis of gender. And, you know, I've succeeded in hearings, but I haven't really got the traction that I should on that. And I intend to take this one further, and I've got some plans on it. And I don't, you and I have discussed it, but it is really concerning. Are you there? Was that just a monologue? Well, the monologue may be continuing to record. So, assuming that I'm here and Kyla's gone into a zone where there's no more coverage for her cell phone, which she's using on speaker in her car to record the podcast, we will move on to the most exciting part of the podcast, and that is
the ridiculous driver of the week.
A surprising bestseller? The Pinpoint Method of cross-examination is catching on. Law firms and new litigators across Canada have caught on to cross-examination, the Pinpoint Method. Kyla Lee's straightforward handbook that teaches you effective cross-examination skills.
So this ridiculous driver is from California, and this is in Oroville, and the driver, let's see if I can get back to the story here, was pulled over with a street sign lodged in their vehicle. And this was an impaired driving investigation. It was a hit and run in South Oroville, California. Yep. And the California Highway Patrol pulled this person over or discovered them? No, discovered a series of fluid clues. This is not uncommon. Sometimes the police will see fluid all over the ground and start following it. And then they went to the home of the driver, and the driver was arrested for impaired driving. But you really have to see the photographs of this sign. So it's an exit sign, it looks like. I know that there's been a case where someone was pulled over where they had a DUI, stop drunk driving sign or something like that. But this one, I don't know, it looks like a Toyota Corolla probably. And this sign is so wedged in there, you cannot figure out how this person would have, I mean, they're lucky to be alive, but how they drove like this. Like, there's a photograph of the windshield, and the windshield's completely smashed, and the sign is facing straight at the driver, and you can see that the exit on the sign. And this is California Highway, but having the car bashed up too. It's a big aluminum.
Maybe
sign.
There was a really good reflection of the road.
I don't know how you
could
see.
Maybe the road reflected off the big aluminum sign.
I don't know.
Just everything backwards.
I don't know how you could have made it home. I mean, you almost want to give them credit for making it the rest of the way home while drunk.
This is the thing, some people say, I'm a safer driver when I've had a few drinks. And then you look at stuff like that and you're like, well, I mean, I couldn't get home like that sober. So
sometimes I had trouble driving at night.
Yeah.
It's pretty awesome. It's pretty awesome. This is an entertaining one. Anyway, Jay, we'll get Jay to post a link to this one and maybe post it on the driving law blog Twitter account, because it's really, really good.
Yeah, that'd be great. All right, well, that's our podcast.
Maybe next week we'll be in the office for the podcast. No? Okay, maybe next week we won't be in the office for the podcast, but there will be a new podcast next week, so tune in to Driving Law. And you can find all of the old Driving Law episodes where we discuss some of the things we referred to, including this case that we mentioned from Saskatchewan, where the individual refused after the police officer took too long. And that's it. Tune in next week for another exciting episode of Driving Law with Kyla Lee.